Welcome to Sci-Fi on Screen, the podcast that goes where no podcast has gone before. We here at Sci-Fi on Screen take a deep, close look at your favorite genre movies of science fiction, horror, fantasy, and comic book land. We go deep, scene by scene. We do comparisons of originals and remakes, and special shows. Just ahead, a new episode. And thanks for listening. Welcome back to another episode. Today we're going to be taking a look at Ridley Scott's 2012 sci-fi epic Prometheus, the last at the moment in the Alien franchise. Before we get into that, do a couple things. One of them is new, one of them is not. First, I want to do some feedback. I want to thank some people who retweeted my Pitch Black podcast, Maggie Toussaint, David Melville, Jason Strong. Thank you guys for retweeting that. I also want to give a shout out to a Facebook commenter, Diego Gonzalez, who reached out to me on Facebook. He posted basically talking about how one of his favorite creature films, and it really got him into kind of the genre. I was curious what I thought about if they had kept Riddick female, because Riddick was originally done as a female hero, like Ripley, you know, because it definitely began as an alien clone for sure. And I, you know, it's funny. I don't think I would have been as interested, although, you know, coming out in 2000, it would have been right in the meat of when, you know, the female action heroes were really kind of starting to really, you know, come up all over the place. But I don't know. I liked that Riddick was a guy. I mean, and I think it's kind of hard to imagine now because Vin Diesel so made the role his own, you know, just the way he took it on, and he was very idiosyncratic about his performance. So he's so indelibly Riddick that it'd be so hard to think of a woman to come along, and you know, the woman would have to really come along and be as interesting and idiosyncratic as he was to make it that, you know, that indelible of a character. So hard to say. I wanted to thank a listener who reached out to me on Facebook, Deb Heyman. She wrote, "Love the show, especially the background info about the director, actors, and the effects." So thanks a lot for that, Deb. Also, a listener named Audrey Tower reached out about Terminator Genesis. A friend of hers worked on the film. I don't want to name the names. I don't know if that she's cool with that, but thanks, Audrey, for reaching out. Thanks to Dean Martin over at Liberty Street Geek, which hosts, among other things, the Science Fiction Film Podcast. He shared my Pitch Black post, and Dean's got mad followers on Twitter, so you know, whenever he throws me up on his page, I get nice numbers that day. So thanks a lot, Dean. So this week I want to debut a new part of the show. I want to talk a little bit about like the week's sci-fi news. I haven't done that before. I usually do feedback and background of the film, and then I jump in. But I thought, you know, there's almost going on every week in terms of news about new sort of genre films coming and going. And you know, and I chat about it with friends of mine. You know, so I thought I would just kind of go over the big hits if there are any. I'm sure there'll be some weeks where there's not, but. So this week, trailers dropped for two films, Doctor Strange and Rogue One, which is called Rogue One, A Star Wars Story. And Rogue One was first. I think it dropped earlier this week. And it really looked good. I really thought it looked really cool. And I really liked Gareth Edwards, who is the director. His last film was the Godzilla film. One thing Edwards can do is he can shoot epic. And the one scene that really grabbed me, I think, in the trailer was the scene of the dish, the main dish of the Death Star being lowered into place, and it's, you know, the shadow it cast being kind of pulled off of a ship, like, and I thought, all right, man, if it's going to be kind of like epic shot after epic shot, even if it's thin character development, I'm in, you know. There was one great shot at the end of the trailer where the camera comes out from underneath something, and you look up and there's AT-ATs everywhere. So I don't know. It just looked great. The character development didn't look amazing. I don't really know the woman who's playing the lead actress. They did get a woman who looks like just like Mon Mothma, which is kind of amazing. So none of the characters really jumped out at me, but you know, he's got some eye. So I'm looking forward to that. And the Doctor Strange trailer dropped too, which really looked good. I wasn't sold on Tilda Swinton as the Ancient One. I mean, you know, I have in my head the Ancient One as the Ancient One, you know. So didn't kind of buy that. But I think Cumberbatch is a terrific actor. And they're going to do the origin story, which there's a spiritual bent to Doctor Strange, which they did wonderfully. I would highly recommend to prepare for this film. Like it's a freaking PhD you got to get, right? That you watch the Marvel... Marvel's done some anime. DC's kind of like ruling the superhero animated film landscape. They're pumping them out like two or three a year, and they're really well done. And Marvel was kind of first on the landscape, and they did a couple that were really, really excellent. The two Avengers ones are really good, but the Doctor Strange one, to me, is really terrific. Really well done. And I never really knew about Doctor Strange. I never read him I never read a Doctor Strange comic. But the origin story they did in the anime is terrific. A very spiritual story, and I thought it was really well done. So I'm hoping that if they keep to that, and it looks like they are since he's in Tibet, you know, his hands get smashed, and if you don't know, and he goes to Tibet because there's, you know, reasonable ways to cure them have failed, and so he has to make this leap, and, you know, it's part of how he becomes the Sorcerer Supreme, and looks like they're going to do it, you know, and it looks really interesting, and they did a lot of cribs from Inception. There are like these shots where cities are kind of closing in on each other that reminded me of Inception, so I don't know, I was kind of psyched. This week, also an image dropped from the new filming of Ghost in the Shell, and it's just a simple still as Scarlett Johansson, as Major Kusanagi. I don't really care, I have to say. Some other podcasters and viewers are putting it up and kind of excited about it. And I think Ghost in the Shell is such a masterpiece that it's gonna they can't not destroy it. They're going to make it some kind of action thingy that has nothing to do with anything. I could be totally wrong, but you know, to do a film like Ghost in the Shell, like in this day and age, is an action sci-fi thing, and keep any semblance of, you know, what really makes the movie special to me. Seems near impossible, but I would love to be proved wrong. I got more information about, if you guys aren't aware of, one of my favorite sci-fi authors is a guy named Ted Chiang, and his collection, The Story of Your Life and Other Stories, I would highly recommend you picking up. I think Ted's about to have his moment, because here's a guy, he's been writing science fiction stories for, I think, about 20 years now. He's only wrote like, you know, maybe 11, 15 stories, no novels. He wrote a novella. And like every story wins like every award ever, you know, possible. Like he's won an award for like every one of his stories. And I'm rereading Story of Your Life, which is just a tremendous story. And the movie's going to come out. The movie's being made by the guy who did Sicario. And it stars Jeremy Renner and Amy Adams. It's coming out, I think, later this year. So kind of psyched to see some stills of that. I'm waiting for the trailer to drop. Kind of psyched. It's about aliens come to Earth and they hire linguists to try to decipher their language. And in deciphering their language, we kind of discover how they think, and it creates perceptional shifts within those who really learn the language, and it's really incredible. I would highly recommend the story as well, which is in that collection. Other news, too, the Star Trek TV show is proceeding apace, and what we seem to learn, I'm not sure how gospel-y this is, but it seemed to come from pretty reputable sources, is that it will not take place in the JJ-verse, which I'm very happy about. I'd like the JJ-verse to kind of end with Beyond and be finished. So, you know, lots of speculation about when and where it's going to take place. There was, I think, part of the article as well that it was going to take place after the Kittimer Accords and, like, before Next Gen. So, you know, that chunk of period of time. But who the hell knows? You know, I'm happy to see Trek come back to the small screen where I think it belongs. More will be developed. Also, news came out that there's going to be a solo Batman movie. Affleck will direct and star. And those of us who've been following this whole, you know, Batman versus Superman debacle will know that, you know, Affleck has really been invited into the creative fold at DC. They kind of want him involved in kind of the way Snyder is involved right now. They want him in. And Affleck, I didn't know that, but people have cued me in that Affleck's been wanting to make a Batman movie like since he was a young actor. So this is like a dream come true for him. So who knows when it's going to take place. Will it be before Batman v Superman or after? Nobody knows, but Affleck will write, direct, and star. So and then the last bit of news comes on the Avatar sequel front. The sequels are being delayed continuously. And Cameron came to CinemaCon 2016 and let us know that there's going to be now a fourth sequel, which in total of five films. So Avatar 2 is coming out in Christmas 2018. Avatar 3, 2020, Avatar 4, 2022, and then the fifth film only a year later, 2023. So he's got quite... It's funny, Cameron and Ridley really have... I mean, the latter parts of their lives, because if Ridley survives making the Alien sequels, you know, he's in his mid-70s, you know? It's going to be at least a 10-year run getting the three Alien prequel movies off the ground. So he's got that, and, you know, Cameron's going to be basically doing these Avatar movies until 2022. So pretty amazing. But yeah, so that was some interesting news. So that wraps up the genre news portion of the podcast. So let's jump in to some development stuff on Prometheus. Development on a fifth film in the franchise was in progress by 2002. Ridley Scott considered returning to the series he created, and he wanted to pursue a prequel that would explore the engineered origins of the alien creatures in the space jockey. Sigourney Weaver also expressed interest in returning to the series. So Cameron came back briefly for a while and talked about some sequel stuff with Scott. And then there was a writer involved. 20th Century Fox approached Cameron with a script for a crossover film that would became Alien vs. Predator, which he was like, we're done. As soon as that came up, he thought that it would minimize the franchise, and he was out of it. So then in May 2009, Fox said the project was now a reboot of the franchise, and then shifted over to an untitled prequel to actually Alien. Development kind of halted at one point when Fox clashed with Scott over his choice of director, because he wasn't going to direct from the beginning. He was going to get this this ad director to direct it. And Fox was adamant that, like, we do this with Ridley or we don't do it. So he agreed. And they hired a guy named John Spates to write the script. And he pitched an idea to Ridley. I guess they met. It's like one of those legends that you don't know if it's true. Supposedly he met Ridley in some place and pitched an idea how to bridge like a prequel series to the Alien series, and Ridley kind of took a shine to it, and he was hired to, you know, to write the bridge script. Previously, he had written this very famous screenplay called Passengers that was on the blacklist for years. It's finally coming out, I think, this year, about a generation ship where a man and a woman awake and everyone else is asleep, and their adventures on the ship. And it was famously on this blacklist for years. He also wrote this kind of mid-budget sci-fi film called The Darkest Hour, which I really liked, actually. I'll probably cover it at some point in the podcast. Cool little mid-budget sci-fi film. So in June 2010, Scott announces that the script is complete, and then he's going to start pre-production, and they're going to start filming in 2011. Then, for whatever reason, it started to change into like being more of an original work. I think the Spates script would have ended the film like on LV-426 with the eggs, and you're ready to roll into the first Alien movie. And at some point, the whole thing changed where, you know, either Fox was pushing or Spates was, or Ridley was pushing, that they want the film to be more of a standalone. It didn't necessarily have to coincide directly with the Alien film. So they hired this guy, Damon Lindelof, who I think he's from Lost, to take Spates' script and sort of pull it out of a direct continuity and rewrite it. He did that, which, you know, is kind of why I think this film is kind of an odd little thing. Then they were going to call the film Paradise, and then they changed it to Prometheus, and that was all confirmed. Let's get to the film, shall we? We open Prometheus with, if you're not, you know, if you haven't seen the opening credits, you'd think it's, you know, a high-def documentary from, like, Attenborough's Planet Earth. Like, it's just gorgeous photography. Oh, he went all over the world to get some of this stuff. I think he went to Iceland for glaciers, and, you know, there are volcanoes here. Just, you know, what we're supposedly getting is this is primordial Earth, and it's just beautiful, man. The textures and the photography. And so much of this movie, even as I start, like, so much of it moment to moment, you just marvel at Ridley's mastery of the medium. Justin, he just photographs things so beautifully. Really beautifully. And where the camera's moving, and as the camera's moving, we start to see some circular shadow kind of flanking the camera, moving past it. And then we kind of end the sequence at this massive waterfall, just beautiful. And we see sort of a kind of spheroid ship hovering. It's not a flying saucer, but it's not cylindrical either. It's somewhere in between. And we see this shrouded figure walking towards the edge of the waterfall, and, you know, it takes its hood off, and it's got this amazing fleshy face. The engineers are really beautifully rendered in this film. They're just incredibly amazing to look at. And they're a mix of in the screen and, you know, just a light sheen of CGI to kind of morph the face a little bit. Really amazing. Then we see the ship that brought the engineer vanish, and it drinks some concoction it starts to slowly dissolve its body. And then we go into the credits proper. I think what they're trying to show us here is that the engineer is being disassembled so it can disseminate all of its DNA strands into the planet's biosphere and thus seeding it for life, which will eventually become us, which is kind of neat. I mean, very Kubrickian in that we're starting a science fiction film, Dawn of Man, right? And there's no doubt that the writers were aware of this. In 2001, you know, we've evolved to a certain level, but kind of hovering in extinction. And the monolith makers come and they sort of they help us evolve to tool-making stage, which saves us and allows us to develop technology and probably everything else that goes along with it. This is sort of, you know, a step further back where we're actually helping to develop us, period. So then we have our Isle of Skye in Scotland scene, and we meet Elizabeth Shaw and Charlie Halloway. Shaw's played by Noomi Rapace, who is best known for playing Elizabeth Salander in the Swedish Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, which is an amazing movie, actually, on its own. Charlie Halloway is played by Logan Marshall Green. So they bust into this cave. Inside the cave, we see all these paintings, which date back, so they say, about 35,000 years. And one of the cave paintings is of sort of a giant figure pointing towards the stars, and there's a constellation. And we hear Shaw say something, I think they want us to come and find them. So we don't know too much about anything yet. We cut right away from this to some beautiful star field, a ship racing through it, which is the Prometheus as a scientific vessel. We get a little stats of the vessel on screen, crew of 17. The date is December 31st, 2093. And they do a distance, how far from Earth, but it's like done in a mathematical formula. But I think it's kind of like 3.5 light years out. Really neat looking ship, a little more sci-fi than Psy, but still kind of a cool looking vessel. This opening sequence on the Prometheus is all about David, the synthetic, played by Michael Fassbender. Everyone else is in cryo sleep. So David's walking around the ship and he's monitoring the humans and he's able to tap into what they're dreaming. He goes up to Elizabeth Shaw's cradle and he taps into her. And so we get a little flashback of her. She was dragged from dig site to dig site as an archaeologist. Her parents, or at least her father, was an archaeologist, and her mother died young. And they have this discussion, her and her dad, about life and death. And the father, they're talking about, and it's the tagline that comes back in the film later. Dad, what do you believe? That there's something after this, but how can you know if it's true? He's like, I choose to believe it's true. And that comes back later on. He's playing basketball. He's learning all kinds of languages, watching Lawrence of Arabia, and using modeling Peter O'Toole as sort of a personal model. So he does kind of doing his hair like Peter O'Toole. His diction is like Peter O'Toole. And it's a pretty solid sequence. It's beautifully photographed. As ever, so much of this movie is just so well photographed. You know, it's so crisp and clean and clear. And things are very well designed. Everything looks very good and very... There's a lot of money up on the screen, man. I'll tell you, it's just, it's an amazing looking movie. Then we get this amazing shot of the planet. As right before the crew begins to wake, you know, the ship is very close to the LV planet. I forget the number of this one. But again, you know, it's so, I just did a Force Awakens podcast and talk about the difference in like photography. I mean, look at the planets in Prometheus or the planet. And they remind me of, prequel and New Hope Lucas. Just very sharp, very well developed and detailed. Beautiful to look at. As so much of this film is, it's such a missed mark in so many ways because it's so beautiful, but it's got a lot of problems. All right, so we'll get to that. The crew begins to wake up, right? And this is in the Alien universe. This is, you know, technically a prequel to Alien. It takes place way before they go to LV-426. So we're getting callbacks to the Alien, at least the first two movies where, you know, crews begin to wake up after hypersleep and get ready for breakfast. This one, there's a woman on board named Meredith Vickers who seems to be the sort of the CEO of this Wayland Corporation. And she's played by Charlize Theron. The women in the cryosleeps are wearing kind of like bandages over their breasts and hips. And she kind of jumps down and starts doing push-ups. And David tells her that mission time so far has been 2 years and 4 months that they've been asleep. So then we meet the rest of the crew around the cryosleep chamber, and Elizabeth Shaw is throwing up. This is very Alien, you know, nicely photographed, feels kind of good. You know, Holloway is looking at her, hey, we made it. We meet Milburn in Fifield. Milburn is the biologist, kind of bespectacled, gentle dude, and Fifield is kind of the punk rocker geologist. And, you know, they're trying to do the realism of the first Alien, which they completely do not do. Milburns introduces himself nicely, and Fifield looks at him like he's got three heads. I'm here to make money, buddy. You know, like he's already got an attitude. The Tron for the grizzled veteran thing that Alien, and even Aliens to some respect, gets really right. But as well as everything's photographed, it looks very fake. It's one thing in this film that I really never gel to is any of the characters. Like, this is such a weird movie in that it's photographed scene by scene. Some of those beautiful science fiction film photography you're ever going to see on screen. Like, this is a how to shoot amazing shit Ridley style. Like, it's a crash course in how to shoot science fiction that looks like as money as you could imagine. And also, at the same time, the story and the characters, who care less, you know? And this is it. Even Idris Elba, who I love, he's got this fake southern accent that's about as fake as you want to get. It all just feels put on. You know, Fifield being like, I'm here to make money, mate. It's all like, it's a put on. It's all like where we're going to create these kind of characters and we're going to push them against each other. But after this, Vickers comes in, you know, she's the cold-hearted corporate CEO, you know, and I have to say Charlize, she's not given anything to work with and she gives a bad performance. So, I mean, I think the two together, her choices here, Vickers is just like a wasted character. I don't even know why she's there. I feel like she's there so they can have that lifeboat for the end of the movie, which they use for, you know, like for 2 seconds, but they have this this wonderful briefing, and they're in like the gym area, and half of it becomes a holographic representation, and we meet Peter Weyland, who, if you're kind of a geek like me, you know that in Alien, the company is the Weyland-Yutani Corporation, and I think even in Alien vs. Predator, the first one, I think Charles Weyland is Lance Henriksen. Anyway, it's played by an aged, artificially aged Guy Pearce. Instantly, what they're not going to do in this film is have David be the reveal. We know he's a synthetic. Weyland outs him immediately as a synthetic, so they all know. And no one really reacts to it at all, which is kind of weird. No one reacts positively or negatively. So they've taken the whole synthetic thing out as a plot surprise completely, and he's just one of the crew. Weyland turns the briefing over to Holloway and Shaw, and we hear that in a wonderfully rendered on-screen thing, they found all these archaeological digs all over the world that that show this same constellation. They then looked at the stars and matched the constellation with this system, which has a sun and a gas giant, and this LV-223 is the planet that had led them there. So, and Shaw and Holloway have dubbed the creatures who have set all this up as the engineers, so it's the first time we're hearing that, and they believe that they're responsible for creating humanity, which, you know, that's a leap. That's nowhere. You know what I mean? But, there it is. And one of the, you know, the crew, they're all like, no one cares. I mean, and this is weird. You know, in Alien, they're all kind of pissed off that they have to, you know, be diverted to discover life. They're not going to get their shares. But you figure that, like, you know, they've been going back and forth across the space lanes for years. And, like, you know, alien life's no big deal in that universe. But in this universe, this is kind of like a real eye-opening, you know, mission in terms of, you know, why they're there, what they're going to do. And to have a bunch of people who don't give a shit, it doesn't make any sense to me. It's like, I think one of the either Fifield or the other guy, like, well, how do you know they created humans? And she's like, it's what I choose to believe, which is what her father said to her, and it found it just very, very shallow, and give me a break. This is your faith versus science, you know, coming together. Like, it's just so, to me, it's so ill thought out. But look, in one sense, forgetting all that, you're it's a hell of a setup for an SF adventure film. You're waking up on a ship, this mysterious Peter Weyland says you're there to discover the progenitors of the human race. There's an android on board. You're heading towards the planet. It does exist. You're there. You're, you know, 3.5 light years away from Earth. Pretty amazing setup. You know, like, what's to come? Like, as a film goer, even though, you know, I'm not really latching on to anyone's story at all, I'm sort of like, all right, you know, what's on the planet? Let's get this sucker going, you know? So it's a hell of a setup, I have to say. The Prometheus' approach to the planet and the landing is about the most beautiful photography you're ever going to see. I mean, it's just gorgeous. So then Vickers invites Holloway and Shaw over to, you know, her little lifeboat. So she lives in this, like, lifeboat, which is detachable from the Prometheus, and you could live on it for, like, 2 years. It's got, you know, all the comforts of home and its own power source and that kind of thing. And during the briefing, Weyland had said, as far as he's concerned, you know, Holloway and Shaw are in charge of the mission. You know, there's this whole thing, like, she doesn't care that they're there. She's just so corporate. Like, you know, we made the money. You're only here because, you know, we made a lot of money and you're nothing. And, you know, you will assess and report back. You're not going to interact with anyone. And she has no power. You know, she's a corporate player with no power. They're not going to, you know, you're not going to listen to this suit who's on board 3 light years from Earth. Like, what can she do if you decide to not go along with what she wants? Like, it kind of doesn't make any sense. So anyway, it's an absurd scene between non-characters. Probably is the best way to describe it. And we find out that the reason why David's been studying all these languages is because if they possibly contact the aliens, he's been studying kind of like, you know, the oldest Indo-European languages possible to kind of get closer to maybe a common language that the engineers might have spoken, since, you know, maybe the language has been diasporaed all around the globe. So it makes sense that he's going to study all these sort of root languages to try to be able to understand the engineers, which is okay, whatever. We hear that the atmosphere is hostile, that you could go out in it, but it would be like a very quickly you would succumb. So it's not so hostile that you can't survive for a minute, but like I think 5 minutes, you're pretty much done. So they land and they find these large circular mounds all set up in a row in this valley. It's really beautiful looking. It's almost like prototype Valley of the Kings, as it were. You know, they're suiting up for their first excursion out. There's this dialogue with David and Holloway, like, hey, David, you know, you're synthetic. You don't even need these suits. Why are you putting one on? David's thing is, you know, I was designed because this is what you're most comfortable seeing. So, you know, in order to fulfill my programming, you know, I'll put on a suit. Fassbender's a little chilly here. He's good as David. I think people have overpraised his performance. I don't think it's a home run, but he's good. You know, there's one tagline that's like, so you're supposed to pass as human. And he's like, at my best, yes. There's a way he says it that's really chilling that you realize David's kind of, that we don't really know what his motives are, if he has any. They roll out on these wonderful transports. Again, all shot very beautifully. All the exosuits are really beautifully created. They have these kind of egg-shaped helmets that kind of go all the way around so you can see people's heads completely. Really neat, just beautiful looking. The structures as they approach them are just gorgeous. They're like these, you know, super giant ant mounds. Incredible. Fifield, who's the geologist, tells them they're hollow and they head inside and down. And it's really neat. Like they're open all the way around. And as you go in, you go down inside of them. So really just, now we're kind of like Indiana Jones in space, which is really neat. And so we're full on explorer mode and Ridley's kind of mixing it up like he did in Alien. So we're getting shots from the helmet cameras as well as from the explorer's point of view directly there and back at the ship on the monitors and regular, you know, beautiful film shots. So really cool, like what he does, you know, keeps things interesting. I like these mapping drones that Fifield has. You know, he throws up these drones that emit these sort of scanning lasers and they both take off. I think he has like 4 or 5 of them, throws them out and they start to map the space. And as they're mapping it, we cut back to the Prometheus. And we see a 3D map of the interior of the structure start to form on this table. Like, it's so cool, man. It's just, you know, this is the kind of stuff you pay your ticket for. Like, it's just so neat. You're seeing the tunnels extend as if by magic on the table. But, of course, it's just the mapping drones are sending back their data. It's amazing. And the first little instance of surprise is that something's manufacturing breathable atmosphere inside these structures so they could take their helmets off, which they do. So they start walking around these long sort of concentric hallways. We see David kind of peel off and he finds some sticky goo on one part of the wall, which he reasons is sort of a, there's hieroglyphics everywhere. And he's reasoning that this is sort of a doorway of some kind or some kind of, you know, key. And so he activates something. And what he activates is like a holographic replaying of the last, you know, the last recorded movements in the area. And so we see in this sort of like, you know, very fuzzy hologram, the space jockeys running down the hallway and they end, you know, with the holographic engineer sort of collapsing because they run after the holograms. They don't think they're holograms. Actually, it's kind of not said in the movie whether they think they're real or not. They wind up chasing the sort of holographic engineers. And when the hologram ends, they find a real body of an engineer that's been decapitated. David finds more hieroglyphics at the wall. He winds up opening the door, and on the other side of the door is the head of the engineer, which is neat. And they're about to go inside and further, and now you get some ridiculous stuff like Fifield and the geologist, the biologist are just scared, and they're like, you know, we didn't sign up for this. I'm a geologist, and I signed up to do whatever. He bolts. He leaves. He's like, I'm going back. Like he walked in, threw some balls around to map the place, and then now he's like, I didn't sign up for this ET crap. I'm gone. It's like, give me, who in their right mind would not be touched by you know, the fact that they may be walking in to find the progenitors of their race, you know, so it's just so stupid. And then the guy who's the biologist, who's supposed to be there in case they encounter any biologicals, kind of nods and like, yeah, I'm going to go with them, you know, and it's such a crock because they're going to, you know, they're going to get lost later and they're going to be used as guinea pigs for our alien, you know, sort of genesis. But it's just pretty dumb. And so they leave anyway. So they carbon date the engineer, 2,000 years old, you know, so they find the helmet again. They can tell that it's kind of humanoid. And we see that the space, there's this huge head, first of all. It's beautiful. This whole design inside this cavern. There's a monstrous head that's very humanoid, and it's surrounded by these mysterious canisters in black, which is really amazing. Of course, it's a complete callback to Alien. We know that anything in these could be eggs, basically, but they happen to be canisters. And there's a bas-relief on the wall, which is all beautiful, very much Giger again, you know. And we get one or two brief shots of a creature that may look like an alien that we know of course. There's ribbing inside, you know, which is sort of like the beginning of that kind of thing, which we get in a lot of Alien and Aliens. And immediately, the top of the little canisters are kind of moving and liquefying. And the murals that were painted at the very top are disintegrating. And it reminds me, I think it's this Fellini film called Roma, where I don't know if he actually filmed it or recreated it when they found certain murals beneath the city. They broke into the chambers, the atmosphere ate them away. So when you were there looking at them, it was the last time any human being would see these murals because they disintegrated. So they tried to do that a little bit in this film and did not work out very well. They didn't really pause and spend a lot of focus time on it. But of course, you know, we see David putting one of the canisters in his backpack, you know, so he's got his own agenda. He doesn't tell anyone what he's doing. From outside, Janek, who's the captain, who's the Idris Elba character, tells him that a storm's coming, so now we've got some tension. We start to see that the oil is seeping out of canisters and into the ground, and we also see that there are normal earthworms in the ground. So, you know, obviously the black oil is now going to interact with the worms, and that's going to be sort of the first biological form it takes, as we'll see later. The storm that's coming is really beautiful. It's what they call a mica storm, so I guess it's blowing mica fragments in the storm at like high velocity, so it's very dangerous. We see as they're running up on the valley, like up on the high mountain, cresting the valley, is this face that looks like a skull that's been carved there, and we'll see it a couple of other times. Really kind of neat. Reminded me of a cover of one of the Dune paperbacks, but really look cool. So they almost, you know, they make it back. They're pretty much there. The storm is upon them. And then the head of the engineer is blown off of one of the vehicles that are on. And so Holloway goes out after it. And then the storm hits en masse and the rest go out after her. So there's this whole scene where, like, the winds are so high that they have to all find her and then winch themselves back in to the ship. It's whatever. It's no bit, you know, it's nothing exciting, really. You know that it's just kind of a thing for the movie. But when they get back, they realize that Milburn and Fifield haven't made it back yet. They got lost. So the artifact, and it's about the most absurd thing. The Fifield's the geologist who actually had the remote to map the place. And, you know, the geologist got lost. This is so stupid. They just want them in that temple alone at night. You know what I mean? So then we get this scene in the med bay. And this is a genius little moment. I don't know which writer came up with this one, but it's a genius moment in that, you know, the space jockey that they found in the first Alien, found that elongated snout and rib cage and everything, was a bloody helmet. It was just so genius, and they cut it off, and inside the helmet is the head of the figure, very similar to what we saw in the opening of the movie. And they notice little black spots on its head. And so they do this thing where supposedly they can introduce a certain kind of electricity back into the head to reanimate it. So it, in a sense, the head, it wouldn't be alive, but it would kind of think it's alive or something. So they do it, and all of a sudden we see the face starts to twitch. It's in pain, and it's really a weird-looking scene. It's where the horror really comes in here. They're all kind of freaking out, like, and they're like, contain it, contain it. And so they finally contain it, and it explodes up and outwards, and we don't really see if anything came out of it. But of course, you know, in our alien universe, exploding bodies are nothing new. If it hadn't been decapitated, that's what may have happened to it 2,000 years ago. And it's just a really cool scene. You know, it's part of this movie, again. Some shots, some little scenes are just really great, you know, on their own. So then we get this conversation. And to me, this totally did not need to be in the movie. David has got some kind of VR helmet on. And it was a very similar helmet he had on when he was overhearing, you know, Shaw's dreams. He's having a conversation near a cryo tube. So you just know that, like, it's probably Wayland, you know, or someone else is there, or someone else is yet to be revealed. And I just don't think they needed it. I think his reveal would have been more interesting without this tip-off. Afterwards, he's buttonholed by Vickers, who's like, what did he say? What did he say? And he's trying to be, you know, coy about it. And she's like, I'll have you killed or whatever. And he's like, he said, try harder, whatever. And Theron is so bad in this. There's no reason why she's there. And then every scene she's in, she just kind of drains of life. But then we have a shot of David. He opens up one of the black cairns that they found. And inside, in these sort of, you know, gelatin pouches, is this fluid. And inside the fluid are these black specks of liquid. And, you know, he basically puts one on his finger. This tiny little speck. It's photographed so well. It's like the most beautiful speck of liquid you ever saw. And so he comes into a room, and Holloway is there getting drunk. And, you know, Holloway's kind of like depressed because the engineers weren't alive. And I think, you know, what kind of a movie is this? Like, he's a scientist, man, and he's come half, like, 3 light years away, and he's actually found evidence of the engineers and all this amazing stuff. And he's getting drunk because he wanted to meet one. You know, it's just stupid. It's just like, almost every character thing that goes on in this movie to me is dumb. And, you know, he talks to David, and David's like, well, what if, why did you make me, you know? And he's like, because we could. And he's like, well, what if that's the answer, you know? And Holloway's being kind of a dick, and I think sometimes so many people died in this that, like, they didn't know who to be sympathetic, and if people were going to die horrible deaths, maybe they wanted to make him dicks so the audience wouldn't turn against the movie. I have no idea. Holloway is about as far from a scientist as I could possibly imagine that I could believe that this actor is playing a scientist. So anyway, back to the med bay. They do this comparison of the engineer's DNA, and it completely matches human beings. And so, you know, there's this moment of, like, they've discovered the progenitors of the human race, which, you know, my God, it's part of what, again, this why this movie is so... It fails in such terrible ways, even though it's beautiful. It's like, this is a momentous thing to discover, and it's just like a little beat in this movie, and no one really cares, you know. Imagine someone coming up to you and like, hey, you know what? We just like discovered the origin of the human race. You'd be like, screw that, man. I'm late for work. You know, like, give me a break, man. Like, you know, but they have to do certain things in the script because the screenwriters make them, and so it's so unbelievable. So we're back inside the, you know, the structure, and Fifield and Milburn, of course, have to wait it out at night, I guess because the storm is going to last all night, and we're not really told, but they have to wait it out in there. They find a pile of engineers, and they report back that it looks like they've exploded from the inside. We get that information. One of the probes that Fifield had thrown up actually stopped someplace, but it was reading a life form, and then all of a sudden the probe vanishes, and they think it was a glitch. So then we have this. We have to have a sex scene between Shaw and Holloway, so we can do the, you know, a bunch of other scenes to come. We find out that Holloway is barren; she cannot have children, and it's just the dialogue between them is stupid. They're stupid. Their relationship is ridiculous. Like, it's just really bad and clumsy. Who are they? We don't even know who they are. We don't know what they want. We don't care, you know. And it's whatever. And then Vickers, they have the sex scene between Vickers and Janik that's supposed to humanize her. That, you know, she's gonna have sex with the captain, and it's all done in very matter-of-fact language. It's completely forgettable. But we cut back to the chamber, and all the cairns are excreting black goo. And now we're going to get our first alien attack. Again, you know, these two of them are just sitting around, and they're hanging out in, like, a, you know, waiting for a subway. Like, oh, this is so lame, man. You know, they're in this alien, on this alien planet, you know, amongst all this stuff, and they're just like, whatever, dude. You know, this is horrible. It's just... doesn't make any sense for me as a viewer. But so the now all of a sudden the goo is moving, and we see that the black, I guess, weaponized goo, whatever it is, has taken the little earthworms that they showed us earlier in the film and has sort of created itself into this snake-like creature. And the creatures are great. I mean, they look really good, very much like the first facehugger looked in Alien. Very real. Milburn is attacked, and the snake wraps around his arm and breaks it, which is really gross. And then Fifield cuts the thing, and of course it sprays blood, which is full of acid, you know, totally dissolving, I think, Fifield's helmet and Milburn's helmet. And then the snake creature gets actually into his suit and goes all the way down Milburn's mouth, very much, you know, back into, you know, male rape, as it were. It's a gross, screwed up horror scene, and it's good for that reason. Like, these are two non-characters that nobody cares about, but it's creepy and gross and just really weird. You know, I really like it. So later on at night, you know, Holloway and Sherrod have sex. Holloway gets up out of bed. During the scene earlier where David and Holloway were, you know, David pours him a drink, he has a little drop on the top of his finger from the canisters in the structure and sticks it in Holloway's drink. So he infects Holloway with the black goo on purpose, very much to see what's going to happen. So David, you know, it's kind of like a really creepy robot. So at this point, Holloway's looking really, really closely at his eye, and he's really kind of, he doesn't feel good. And a very tiny tendril of goo comes out of his eyeball like this little tiny worm. Really kind of gross. So then David, finding out that the probe discovered life, kind of goes back into the temple by himself, and he goes to find the probe. And he finds the probe halted in front of this door, and he opens it, and we're in this new chamber. It's amazing. It's thousands and thousands of these canisters filled with this black weaponized goo. And it looks like it's like ancient wine cellars. It's a really great set. I mean, they're stacked in ways that make them look like pillars. They're really cool looking. And then finally, he goes into the next chamber, and we're back to our platform from Alien, which is where they found the space jockey, which is really, you know, definite, you know, we're visually, we know what's going on. Very cathedral-like. Vickers has been following his progress on the camera. David shuts it off to hide what's going to happen from her. Who the hell knows why? Then we see these four, you know, kind of hibernation pods there. Just want to take a quick minute to let you know a couple of ways you can support Sci-Fi On Screen. One way is to use Patreon. Patreon is a crowdfunding site that works by allowing users to contribute on a show-by-show basis. All you do is choose a dollar amount you want to contribute, and every time one of my podcasts appears, you'll be debited the amount you choose. You can donate as little as $1 per show. That's $4 a month or $52 a year. No obligation, and you can cancel or adjust the rate at any time. And the best part is it keeps me honest. If there's no show, there's no charge. And it would help to defray hosting costs and for my time to put the shows together. The link is on my website, top right-hand corner, and signing up at Patreon is a snap by clicking on Become a Patron. There's also a great way as if you would like to buy the Blu-ray copies of any of the movies that I've reviewed on my podcast. Just simply go to the website, click on the movie page, and go ahead and click on the Blu-ray below the podcast, and it'll take you right to Amazon. If you purchase it, I get a few bucks from that as well. And I always appreciate it if you're on Twitter to retweet my podcast as they appear and spread the word. So the next day, they go out in search of Fifield and Milburn, and they find them. And on the mission, Charlie's starting to get very, very sick. We see the creature bail out from Milburn, so they know that something's going on, and they can't find Fifield, but Milburn is there and really gross. And we cut over to David, and he's now on the platform, and he activates one of the chairs and sits in it. And then we get another kind of hologram, and we see the engineers walking and moving, and he's watching them manipulate the control, so he's learning how to, you know, work the ship. They blow this kind of little pan pipe. It's part of the control, you know, system of how to get this thing up and running to activate something. And now we see this massive, beautiful, beautiful 3D model of space, all these different planets, and I mean, it's such a beautiful scene. It's ridiculous. And we get to Earth's holographic image, and it's David's kind of holding the hologram of Earth in his hand, and then everything vanishes, but the Earth was kind of the center of it all. You know, we're not sure what that means yet. We're going to find out soon. And then the caveat of all caveats, one of the engineers from the ship is still alive in its cradle. So now we're getting, things are escalating. The team is coming back from the structure. Holloway is blackening visibly, transforming into something. Vickers grabs a flamethrower in the ship, and she opens the door, and she's like, you only get in if I don't think you're contaminated. And she won't let Charlie in. And of course, Shaw's like, he's sick. He needs to get to med bay. And she's like, I won't let him in. And Charlie kind of knows what's happening to him, and he walks into the flamethrower on purpose because he kind of knows that, you know, the thing's taking him over and he wants to die, and so she kills him, burns him to death. And we don't really give a shit. We don't really know this character, so we don't really care. Shaw's crying at the top of her lungs because that's what her character's supposed to do, but nobody cares. And then there's this whole moment where Fifield now is here, and he shows up, and he's all black gooed up. There's this scene of him fighting, and you know, he's almost unkillable. They're shooting him and trying to burn him and kill him, and you know, he kills like a bunch of people before they finally subdue him. And it's not very interesting because it's not like we're seeing more creatures. We're just seeing like men that are like been taken over, kind of zombified, and just really strong. So I don't know. It's kind of boring. And later on, Shaw's being analyzed by David, and David's asking, did you have sex with Holloway? You're 3 months pregnant. So it's kind of a big deal. Shaw wants to see it, and David won't let her. And she immediately freaks out, knows that, you know, something's going on. She wants an out of her. But then she's kind of like in this pain, and she crouches over, and David jabs her with a sedative. So it's really creepy, you know, very much that, like, he's going to sedate her. And take her back, pregnant as a specimen, of course, part of the alien thing that we do. And then he does this thing where it's like, he's just a creepy, horrible robot, and he's like, such a shame about Holloway, so similar from your father's death from Ebola, you know, and we don't care. I'm like, we didn't see that on screen. That was just, so that's just told to us now, and it's like, give me a break. So David sends in two crewmen to try to, you know, lock her down, and she busts out, and then there's this unbelievable scene. This scene is incredible. Where she gives herself an abortion in the medical bay. It's unbelievable, man. It's just like, so they must have thought of this one and been like, oh, this is the centerpiece of the movie. It's crazy. You know, the whole thing of, like, you know, even as a guy, just thinking, like, you know, something's alive inside you that's this horrible monster. And, you know, she gets in and she's got a, it's such a tense scene where, like, you know, of course the medical machine's like, please state the nature of the emergency, and she's got to, like, hurry it up. And you know, so they finally cut it her open and bring it out, and it's starting to uncoil and wake up, and it's alive, and she rips the cord herself, which I think is an amazing cinematic thing. She rips the cord, but then, you know, she can't get out of the little pod. So there's the thing right there, flipping out, flipping around, all gross and mucousy, and she's like waiting for the med pot to open, and then you're just like, oh, it's such an intense scene, really crazy. And at the last, she has to kind of slide right under it, like maybe 3 inches from under this thing, which is like kind of a prototype of like a little Cthulhu, like a Lovecraftian kind of tentacled monster. It will grow in size amazingly. And so she hits the quarantine button, and it's kind of trapped in the tube, but, you know, we know it ain't dead. Part of her recovery, too, is that the machine staples up her gut. And it's kind of hard to believe that she can actually do anything after a cesarean section with her belly kind of stapled shut, you know, that she's running around doing stuff the whole rest of the time. But, you know, if it was a good movie, I wouldn't care. And the fact that it's, you know, put together so shoddily that I'm sort of like, I also don't care. You know, it's a weird way. They get away with it either way, right? Now Shaw bursts into the medbay proper. This was like the private little medical pod that Vickers had that's like so rare. And she bursts into the medbay, and there sitting on a wheelchair, of course, is Peter Weyland. And we're not surprised because we've been primed for it, which I don't understand. David tells her about the one engineer that's living, and this has been Weyland's whole thing. He wants to go meet his maker, and he wants to see if there's a secret of immortality. You know, Shaw's like, this isn't the place we thought. It's a whole different place. We were so wrong about what this is. You know, Weyland's like, have you lost your faith, Shaw? Which is just so stupid. But they're going to bring her along. Like, you know, please come with us, because really Shaw and Holloway are the ones that got him there. So he's quite forgiving, even though, you know, David tried to impregnate her and keep her impregnated with the alien. So then Jonick busts in, and he pretty much explains the movie in layman's terms. He's like, you know, Shaw, this is an installation. The engineers are creating weapons of mass destruction. One, you know, they got away and it killed them. You know, we can't let this stuff get back home. If we get any of this stuff gets back home, we're done. You know, which is going to set up the end of the movie. So then there's a confrontation between Vickers and Weyland. There's antagonism here. She seems to hate him. And then we find out that he's her dad. And it's like, who cares? You know, she has absolutely no reason to be there. I mean, obviously she does. It's her father. In some weird way, she, you know, wants daddy validation, and that's what we're supposed to believe, but it's all so bogus that, you know, who cares? We get the little Weyland group heading out to meet their maker, the engineer. When they walk through the cargo hold, Shaw sees all the cairns of the black goo, and Jannik sees it on the, you know, on her camera. And then Jannik does a little scan, and he realizes that what they're in is actually a ship buried underground, and this, you know, those of us paying very close attention, the shape of it is very close to the sort of horseshoe that was sticking out of the ground in the first Alien. We get a sense that the aliens were in the process of, they were about to go back to Earth to wipe out the planet when the creatures got loose and decimated them. So then we have the big moment, which is, this is such a ruined payoff. Like the big engineer gets up, David tries to talk to him. It's a duplicate of the guy in the prologue. Like, it's an amazing, beautiful looking scene. Like the engineer is really cool looking. They're just so neatly designed. So David talks to him in his kind of language. The engineer kind of roars and decapitates him and kills everybody else. And that's it. I guess angry that somehow that, you know, they didn't get to Earth in time to wipe these their creations from the galaxy. Who the hell knows? It's so ludicrous. But the engineer now powers up the ship. We do see that when he's this big device, you know, in the first Alien movie, when we come upon the ship, he's sitting at what looks like a large, on the platform, it looks like he's sitting behind a huge telescope or some kind of big, long thing. So in this film, they retcon to say that this is how the ship actually works. So he sits in the chair, sort of the helmet comes back around his head with the large snout and the cord. The bones that go around his body are actually artificial to keep him in place. So, you know, it's kind of fun to see that in a way, but, you know, whatever. Now we get a lot of like emergence movement. The ground's breaking up. Things are opening. The ship is on its way. It emerges. And we have this tense moment where basically Janik and Vickers are on board the Prometheus. Vickers is like, we're going back to Earth. And Shaw and Janik are talking. And Janik realizes that he's going to have to sacrifice the Prometheus to knock the ship down. And Vickers, you know, of course, countermands him. But Janik's like, you got 30 seconds to get to your life pod. Otherwise, you're going to join our fate. So he ejects the lifeboat. And then she gets in a life pod and has to go find it later. And it's really weird. They have this moment where the Prometheus does impact the alien ship and takes it down. And it's so strong that it doesn't come apart, but it actually rolls. And it's pretty crazy how they film it. I mean, kind of cool. Basically, Vickers and Shaw are the only two people left alive. And Vickers is crushed under it, you know. We're supposed to find that vindicating that the corporate toady is crushed by this thing. Ooh, nobody cares. You know, Shaw escapes, makes it to the lifeboat, but on the lifeboat is that tentacle thing that was pulled out of her, and the engineer is there. And so David now somehow, even though he's been decapitated, can still contact her. So that he's in communication and he's like, the engineer is there to kill you. So she grabs this axe, but then we get this great scene. And the engineer starts to attack Shaw because it wants to kill her. But then the tentacled alien has grown to like 10 times its size and it bursts out of the med bay and grabs the engineer. And they have this fight. Oh my God, it's really incredible when the two of them are battling. It's like now it's very Lovecraftian. It's got these really creepy, it's got this mouth in the middle of it. And it's got all these tentacles and, you know, the engineer is fighting against it and really trying to hold its own. And they, you know, he holds on as much as he can. And then finally it mouth rapes him basically and jams a part of itself all the way down his throat, takes him down, and he's subdued and it's going to lay whatever embryo in him. So, but it's a really incredible scene. Again, you know, some scenes in this movie, I think I would just buy the Blu-ray and just every once in a while sit through just some of the scenes because they're just, the scene between the tentacled alien and the engineer is amazing. It's just amazing. It's a shame that it's in kind of a wasted movie. You know, David tells Shaw that that wasn't the only ship, and David knows how to fly the ships because he saw kind of the movie on how to fly it. She retrieves David's head, puts it in a bag, or finds a second ship, and they kind of take off. And she doesn't want to go home. She wants to go to the engineer planet, wherever they're from. So she retrieves her cross, which was taken from her by David earlier, which was supposed to be this, you know, moment that we really cared about. We don't. And so they take off and they're going. And then the final tag here, we kind of cut back to the med bay and an alien bursts out of the engineer's body. And, you know, it's sort of very familiar. It stands up and hisses at us and it's a very familiar shape to what's to come, obviously. And then we see the second set of jaws and we cut and we're done. So the thing about Prometheus is a really weird thing. It's really just a bunch of parts thrown together. It's not really a movie. I don't really find it to be of interest to me as a film. But scene for scene, there's some of the most beautiful shots. It's more what I kind of come to expect of late Ridley these days, where the guy can just photograph, man. He can just shoot and frame such beautiful things. And he, you know, he's got the clout to get a lot of money in his production design. So there's a lot of stuff that he does on in front of the camera. He doesn't do a lot of post CGI crap. It's really beautiful looking. But the central quest is, although it's a nice idea, it's completely underdeveloped. And, you know, there's no payoff at all. At all, you know, and there's no, we don't experience the story and the idea through any characters that we care about that have any depth whatsoever. The only character that is even marginally interesting is Michael Fassbender's David, you know, and not much there either. You don't know these people. You don't know their motivations about any of it. They try with Shaw with the, you know, the faith backstory, but it's absurdly underdeveloped and underwritten, or written by people who have no concept of faith whatsoever. They're banding it about like some alien device, as it were. You know, I marvel here at Ridley's craft, you know, but it's a mess of a film. It does not work. I'm really kind of saddened now they're going to go ahead and make three more of these bloody things, three more prequels to Alien, and that's going to be kind of his legacy. You know, like Cameron's going out with Avatar, he's going out with the Alien universe, because he's in his mid-70s now. Like, he's got to be at least 10 years of making these movies. I mean, you know, will he live to see the end of it, you know? And I think he's going to direct them all, but I'm not interested. I mean, I don't think there are any more really interesting stories to be told in this universe, because of the horror element, they can't go pure sci-fi and just do like a 2001 or try to do an Interstellar. Not that I think Interstellar is very good, but, you know, I feel like if Prometheus was done as a straight sci-fi movie and you didn't have to do the horror and you got more into the ideas and the characters and the people who were, how they related to the ideas, discovering your maker and the progenitor of the human race, you know, maybe that's a sci-fi movie for another era. Maybe maybe the powers that be don't let that movie get made these days because it's not sensationalistic enough. But so there's an idea there that's interesting. Who are these engineers? What have they done? But it all has to, they have to throw in so much of the Alien franchise to sell the movie that it just adulterates any kind of real science fiction story that they're trying to tell, you know? So I think the Alien movies work best when they just try to tell either horror stories or action stories, and they don't get too heady. And this one tried to get really heady, but it had to do all the baggage of the Alien films, and it tried to mash them together. Like Sunshine, which I'll cover in a future podcast, which I also wish would have worked, but I really didn't think it did. So yeah, so that's how. And I cover Prometheus because as a franchise, I'm trying to cover the main franchises that we have now: the Star Wars, Star Trek, you know, Terminator, Alien, you know, the main sci-fi, the Matrix, and you know, the main franchises all the way through, because you know they're significant enough where you know each film in the franchise, for the most part, I think, should have a look, because the franchises are so much part of the fabric of the sci-fi cinematic landscape itself, you know. So anyway, if you liked Prometheus, I apologize. I really hacked on it a lot, and I really don't like a lot of it. But boy, is it beautiful. And that's all I've got to say about Prometheus. Thanks for listening. Thanks once again for listening to Sci-Fi on Screen, to my returning listeners and new listeners alike. If you like what you heard, head on over to iTunes and give us a review. We'd love to hear from you. If you have any suggestions about the show, you can send an email to scifionscreen@gmail.com, or feel free to leave a comment on the website, www.scifionscreen.com. And you can leave a comment in the comments section of the show page. If you'd like to support scifionscreen.com, you can go to patreon.com/scifionscreen. And that's Patreon is P-A-T-R-E-O-N. And to make it easy on yourself, there is a button on the webpage that you can click. Patreon is set up so you can pick an amount you want to contribute per episode, and it'll be recurring. If you'd like to do that, that is available. We'd appreciate all the support we can get. And you can find us, again, our website, www.scifionscreen.com. We have a Facebook page. And on any smartphone, you can search for us on the podcast app and subscribe. Thanks again. See you next time.